This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Hi, I'm Bill Radke. I'm glad you've tuned in today. What if the Sonics came back to Seattle, not in a brand new shiny Soto Stadium, but in good old Key Arena in Seattle Center? Here to explain, Seattle Times reporter Jeff Baker. Hey, Jeff.
Hey.
Good to see you.
Great to be back.
I thought Key Arena was small and shabby. And a billionaire is going to build a glitzy new one in Soto. Why are we talking about Key Arena?
Well, it is small and shabby, but the idea is to make it a lot nicer than it is right now. The reason they're looking to build at it is because the city's been trying to build an arena in Soto District for the last several years. No teams have come, and so we're kind of at an impasse with that. And in the meantime, the deal that they had with the developer down in Soto District, Chris Hansen, is about to expire in December of this year. And if no teams were to come, he would have to rip up the old agreement, and that would be it. And so because they're doing that, they're now able to take a look at other locations around the city, which they haven't been able to do during the 5 years they've had this deal with Hansen. Now that it's about to end, he's given permission to look at other deals, and that's what they're doing. And all of a sudden, these deals are multiplying at Key Arena because it hasn't been an open process up till now.
And there are companies coming to Seattle and saying, we'll pay for it, privately funded, spruce up Key Arena.
Not just companies. We're talking about the biggest arena companies in the world. AEG, Anschutz Entertainment Group, which manages the marketing at Key Arena right now, and the Oakview Group, which is run by Tim Leiwicki, who used to run AEG, and by Irving Azoff, who's one of the biggest names in the concert music promotions universe.
Uh-huh.
And so you got two of the heaviest hitters in the business that want to come here, and they say they'll do it with private funds. Of course, they're going to get something out of it. They'll probably get tax breaks. They'll probably get one thing or the other. Nothing's ever free in this universe, but the construction would be, the city's asking for 100% private construction, and they're saying they're ready to do that.
And why would a company pay to rehab Key Arena without knowing for sure that the NBA is going to create a new team that would come here?
Because the people that are going to do that, the two companies I've just mentioned, are ready to build it as a standalone facility that would host concerts, events, big-time music. That's one thing this city lacks right now. I mean, they have Key Arena for concerts, and it's okay, but it's not...
CenturyLink Field?
Yeah, CenturyLink Field. Safeco Field's actually my favorite place to see a concert. I've seen a couple of them there already. And I've got to say that Seattle lacks the indoor, 15,000 to 20,000 seat arena, that state of the art that you see in other markets. And both of these companies feel that there is a definite market for that in this city. And they're ready to build it just for that alone. And if NBA, NHL comes, they're ready to adapt it for that. It'll be adaptable for both leagues.
Wow, there's that much more of a concert opportunity. Kanye West was at Key Arena. Ariana Grande's coming. I feel like they get big names.
They get some big names, sure, but there's also other big names that bypass this city and go elsewhere. U2 pops into my head. I had to drive up to Vancouver to go see them play a few years
U2's
back.
Playing Key Arena instead of CenturyLink or Safeco?
No, U2 was playing Vancouver.
I know, but they would if it was nicer?
They might. I can't speak for Bono. I haven't talked to him in a couple of days, but I would assume that they would give this a bigger consideration.
All right. Well, just text him, would you, and let me know before this interview's over. But okay, here's what I want to know now, Seattle Times reporter Jeff Baker. Why? Why would you add Sonics traffic to Seattle Center? Have you driven anywhere near South Lake Union lately?
I drive by it every single day, and I know all about the traffic that's there. I also drive by a lot of other places in this city. I covered the Seattle Mariners for 8 years, and I had to drive to Soto every single day when I was here, and I had to drive by it when I was on my way to Mariners road trips on the road. I had to drive by the Soto District, and I can tell you the traffic's pretty horrendous there when you have games. The traffic's horrible all over this city, and there's going to be more people coming in. It's going to get worse as
Expedia is coming to Inner Bay, not far
right
away.
Right to my neighborhood right now. That's where I live, the Inner Bay area, and I can tell you the traffic's already bad there. So, I mean, there's going to have to be traffic solutions. Clearly, they can't just open up a brand new arena, Key Arena, without that. That's one of the major things the city's asking for in these requests for proposals to renovate, which were issued yesterday. Transportation has to be figured out. Is it going to be solved entirely? No, unless they have like the biggest genius in the history of traffic solution, it's not going to be perfectly solved, but they have to make it a better arrangement than there is right now over there. And that's up to people a lot smarter than me to come up with. And if they can't do that, the people involved with this themselves say they're not going to go ahead with it. So we'll see. We'll see whether they can get it done.
I just can't imagine, except for teleporting tens of thousands of people, how you quote unquote solve. I mean, just that. Much road.
I'll tell you what. I asked the president of AEG, Bob Newman, yesterday. I asked him that very question. And he told me, look, we've done projects all over the world. And you know what? I didn't grow up here. I grew up in Montreal. I've lived in Toronto. I've traveled I've been to almost every big city in North America. and spent extensive time in all of them covering Major League Baseball for 16 years. I can tell you, we're not the only city in the world that's ever had traffic issues. Every big city in the world deals with the same thing. When they build a new sports facility, when they build a new arena, there are always traffic issues that have to be worked out. And Bob Newman of AEG reminded me of that yesterday, that I was kind of thinking a little too myopically living here in Seattle, thinking we're the only people in the universe that invented traffic trouble. And that's not the truth. I mean, people, when there's a will, there's a way. And if you want to find a solution, you're going to find a solution. And if they can't find a solution here and there's a better offer in Soto District, the city will go with Soto's arena plan. That's pretty much all there is to it. I doubt that the city's going to deliberately tie itself up and paralyze itself in gridlock for decades to come, you know, without trying to find alternatives. And if they do, there'll be people that have to pay for it. You know, and I mean, really pay, not with money, but pay for it with reputations, with all the other nasty stuff that comes with that. But they have to find a solution.
Do you think Sonics fans really care whether the team is in Soto or Key Arena?
I do not believe that the vast majority of them really care. There's a very vocal subset of fans out there, not just Sonics fans, but sports fans, that I think have been so accustomed to having it drilled into their head over the last 5 years that Soto is the only option, that there's no other possibilities in this city, that nobody would come here and pay for a Key Arena renovation. All of those ideas have been debunked, by the way, since the city opened up the process. It was a closed process before, but I think over the last 3 or 4 years, they've been so conditioned to think that Soto is the only option that a lot of them, this vocal segment doesn't want to believe it, and they only think that the city should really hand the deal to Chris Hansen right now in Soto District because there is no other way. It's impossible. But meanwhile, you've got these corporations worth billions of dollars telling you that it is possible, and they're willing to spend seven figures and higher to study it and figure out solutions for it. So, you know, me not being an expert in this thing, and I doubt many of that small subset of fans are expert in this thing, I would just caution them to let the process play itself out for a few more months, and you'll have your questions answered. See which the better site is, and if Key Arena's better, go with that. If Soto's better, go with that.
What does the NBA prefer? I thought leagues want sports palaces.
Well, you see, that's another misnomer that's been allowed to fester here in Seattle for the last 4 or 5 years, that the leagues don't want these kinds of things. It's not true. It's totally not true. The trend, the new trend in arena building around the country in both the NBA and the NHL has been towards the facilities that are actually there, the inside amenities for fans, amenities in technology, in Wi-Fi, in food and beverage, in comfort, luxury seating, premium seating. It's all about the experience.
So small is okay.
Small is okay. It's not. But
nifty.
The word they use is intimate.
Intimate.
It's creating more intimacy. Because
that's what a Sonics game is. It's intimate.
Well, I grew up in Montreal where they built the biggest, and I covered the opening of it. The biggest arena in professional hockey is in Montreal, the Bell Center, 21,000 seats. And I covered that opening 20 years ago. That was the trend 20 years ago. Uh-huh. Bigger is better. Cram as many, you know, butts into seats as you possibly can. Make as much money as you can for the owners. Nowadays, with big screen TVs, people want to stay home and watch their sports on television. They don't want to go and freeze and trouble themselves with parking and walk all around and squish into seats. They want to stay home. And so how do you make the experience better at the arena to get them into the arena is now the big concern in sports business. I'd say going back the last probably 3 to 5 years, that trend has been emerging. It doesn't mean
But why not make it fancier and have lots more seats? Well, then everybody's happy and you're making more money, right?
Because when you make it a little bit smaller, you give the fans better sight lines.
Okay.
You give the fans better access to services, better access to things. And yes,
okay.
I've asked Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, I asked him directly what his opinion of a Key Arena remodel would be. He says he's open to it, and he says remodels can be just as good as new buildings with the new technology that's out there today.
We just have a minute. The roof seems to be a big deal. The Key Arena roof has to stay intact?
Well,
what's the big deal about the roof?
Anything over 50 years old in this city gets consideration for historical landmark status. And the people that work for the city have determined that Key Arena and itself, and largely because of the roof, meets all 6 criteria for that. It would have to go in front of a panel. But the thinking within the city is that in all likelihood, it will be designated as historical. And so any attempts to renovate it will have to keep the spine intact and the roof intact, the integrity of the structure intact. You can't just knock it down and start all over again. And the roof's a big part of that designation because it was, you know, designed by Paul Theury, who's a pretty famous architect in these parts. And that's what has to be done. So they're telling anybody any plan has to involve interior renovation, keeping the roof intact, the spine intact. You can present a separate plan for demolition, but that's only if, you know, the city is surprised and somebody says, no, it's not a historical landmark.
Wow. That's a very important roof. I didn't realize. Finally, you are a sports guy. The Seahawks play the Falcons this weekend. Will their dreams die in Atlanta just like the Huskies' dreams did?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think it will at this point. The Detroit team that they played looked like they were at the end of their rope last weekend, whereas the Falcons have been rested up for a couple of weeks. The Seahawks have to get their running game going. And you know, it's questionable whether they can, because they got to keep Matt Ryan off the field. They can't have the Falcons' offense on there, because the Seahawks won't be able to score enough points to keep up if that happens.
And that was candid. I like the honest answer. That was not a homer answer.
It's not a homer. I don't think it's going to happen.
That's a Seattle Times reporter, Jeff Baker, answer. Always good to see you, Jeff. Thanks for filling us in on this.
Hey, great. Thanks for inviting me.
Uh-huh. Always a pleasure to see you. KUOW is The Record, live tweeting at KUOW. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. President Obama issued an executive order a few years ago that made it easier for transgender people to change their gender with the Social Security Administration. Well, that could change in a Trump presidency. Trump has threatened to abolish many of Obama's executive orders, and this has parents like Marlo Max scrambling to update the legal documents of their trans children.
Everybody's panicking. That's what it feels like to me.
My friend Amelia has a transgender daughter the same age as mine.
Our poor doctors are all flooded right now, though. You know, I tried to get a hold of my kid's pediatrician the other day, and he's so swamped right now with everybody wanting to get certificates changed and letters from the doctor, and he's so swamped.
I've just had this urge to want to hide my child. I mean, just, you know, in every possible way, officially, you know, with all the documents. And I guess I just hate the idea that I have to be scared, that I can't assume that the federal government or any government is going to have our back and protect her rights. And that is just, for me, that's so
minority status.
Right.
You know, I feel like we're coming out of we woke up from our privilege.
A local transgender advocacy group called the Gender Justice League announced a free legal clinic where you could talk to an attorney about how to change your name and gender on official documents. I decided to go and see if they could help clarify how to change my child's Social Security record. The clinic was packed, and there was an army of attorneys volunteering their time to help. They sat behind fold-out tables with signs taped to them, showing what they could help with. Driver's license, birth certificates, passports, and Social Security. As I stood there waiting for my turn, it struck me how often our name and gender are listed on things and how little we think about it until they're listed wrong. And it's more than just an inconvenience. In the majority of the United States, there are no legal protections for transgender people. The wrong documents can cost you your job or your home, or get you detained at the airport, or get you beat up, or worse. And every person in that room must have known this all too well.
So, let me see what's on your phone. Okay. You're here for your kid.
Yes. Yeah, she's 9. We're almost 9. I got a lawyer all to myself.
So I have her birth certificate amended from Washington State, and I have the court ordered name change from King County.
Okay.
And a doctor's letter.
Unfortunately, the event was more geared toward adults, not kids.
My first guess would be that it's, you just do it like you would do for a non-minor.
You'd think I'd be used to this by now. The fact that every time I have a question about something related to my transgender child, it feels like I'm the first one to ask it.
That would be my best guess.
And the experts, the doctors, the teachers, the attorneys, aren't really sure what to tell me.
Thank you. This is great. Well, I'll figure it out. This was really helpful, though, talking this through with you. Thank you so much.
That's when I end up back where I always do, calling on the coolest group of moms I know. So, what are we going to do?
About life? Oh, my
my gosh.
I'm more stressed out about this than I thought it would be.
There's definitely a lot of people in freak out mode.
I panicked again.
What other election have we ever had where four-year-olds know who won?
So have you got your kiddos' documents all changed?
We have one left, and I want to get it done before January 20th. Yes, I do.
I feel like I can't quite get a read on what papers I need to bring.
I was just going to bring his birth certificate.
I brought his old Social Security. I brought his birth certificate. I mean, I brought everything I had.
Anything else?
Oh, my God, my dear.
He's like, birth certificates do not count. And I was like, what?
I realized I probably wasn't going to be able to figure everything out in advance. And I didn't want this hanging over my head during the holidays. So 2 days before Christmas, I made plans to head downtown and get my daughter's Social Security record changed. Or at least give it my best shot.
And you can find out whether Marlo Mack was successful or not by listening to her podcast, How to Be a Girl. It's a collaboration with KUOW. You can hear the whole episode and subscribe to How to Be a Girl wherever you get your podcasts. Washington State's one of the few places in America where undocumented immigration is rising. President-elect Trump promised more immigration enforcement, more deportations. He'll cut off funding, federal funding, to sanctuary cities like Seattle. That is why KUOW's immigration team is looking into how Trump's administration could affect people here. Jorge Barone is on a mission to change the way we think about immigrants. He's executive director of the Northwest Immigrants' Rights Project. They provide legal assistance to immigrants and refugees. And Barone says since Election Day, he's hearing from people who are afraid of what's coming.
I think perhaps one of the most heartbreaking stories for me was this young woman who had come to the U.S. a long time ago, had been here for over 15 years, and she came to me because she was very concerned about her daughter. So she's got a couple of children here in the U.S. who were born here, so they're U.S. citizens. But her older daughter has some serious developmental disabilities, and so she needs very intense care. And she came to me and said, I was trying to figure out if there's anything that I can do because my daughter has these disabilities, whether that qualifies me for some sort of protection.
To stay with her.
To stay with her because she was afraid, what's going to happen now if I get detained? She's a single mom. She's really struggling as it is to keep up with her daughter. And she's saying, if I get detained, who's going to take care of her? How can I do that? Is there anything I can do to try to protect myself beforehand? And unfortunately, I had to tell her, there isn't anything that you can do beforehand. If you get detained, if you get placed in deportation proceedings, there may be some way that you can ask the judge at that point. But she's in this limbo, right? So there's nothing that she can do proactively to try to get immigration status simply on the basis of her daughter having a disability.
So there's one person you have to say, I can't help you. What are things that you can do and are doing right now?
Well, so I think we're trying to make sure that people understand, first of all, what their rights are so that they understand if they, get asked questions by an immigration agent that they have the right to remain silent, things like that. But also, particularly for parents, we want to make sure that they are prepared for what happens. We've seen in the past when people got detained that oftentimes children were left behind. So we want to make sure that they have a plan in place so they have a designated person who's going to pick up their child if they get detained, that they have the documents. An authorization, for example, to take the child to medical appointments, that they have that information updated with their school or childcare. So we've actually, there's some of our partners and us have been working on creating this, what we call a family safety plan. It's kind of like earthquake preparedness. It might be for the rest of us. Unfortunately, for undocumented community members, that's one of the things that they're going to have to worry about. They had to worry about before, but now, I think the risk is much higher.
Yeah. What happens to my children? What happens to my property, my assets, right? You've got to have a whole plan.
Even for those for people who don't have children, exactly. People have built lives. I mean, we have people who have, own houses, own cars. And so if I get deported, who's going to take care of all those, practical things?
This crackdown on undocumented immigration, it's not just coming from Donald Trump. There are many Americans who think undocumented immigrants should go back where they came from, get in line like everyone else, and apply to come here the right way. What do you think they're missing?
Well, I think what they're missing is that there isn't, for a lot of people, there isn't this magical line that people can get into, right? So there's certain pathways for people to be able to come here legally. But for a lot of people that we're talking about, for a lot of people in the undocumented population, there wasn't a path for them to be able to come here legally. There aren't those opportunities. A lot of people actually have come because they're fleeing, pretty desperate situations, a lot of violence in a lot of their home countries as well. And so there isn't a path for them to be able to apply legally. And even for those that do have, you know, certain family ties, for example, to be able to come here, the lines have become so, you know, ridiculously long. So people who are trying to apply from the Philippines or Mexico are waiting well over 20 years. So that realistically, our system has become so backlogged that a lot of people have simply given up. And that's why a lot of us have been calling for immigration reform that really looks at the entire system and looks at what our country needs and what's ultimately fair. There's a lot of injustices and unfairness built into the immigration system right now that we need to address before we go, you know, try to enforce a harsh system.
Well, you're saying it's hard to immigrate to the United States. That's our policy. Why is it fair to, as they say, cut in line?
I think it's important to understand that, you know, throughout our history of the U.S., you know, we've always had unauthorized migration. And the question to some extent is like, what do you do after a certain point, right? What are the consequences? And so, you know, in a lot of the immigration reform proposals, people have had to go through a process to, you know, run through background checks to pay fines for that violation. But the question is, when we get to, you know, families who've been here for, you know, the majority of the people who've been undocumented have been here for more than 10 years. Many of them have children here. So we have to be conscious about what are the consequences. We can be very harsh, or we can recognize that people have built lives here and that this is going to have a big impact, a humanitarian impact on families and people who are deeply ingrained in our communities. And that actually it's better for us as a country to be generous and forgiving in that sense, because they're part of the community now, they're part of the fabric. And so I think we can approach this from a very harsh way. But many aspects of our law, you know, we make decisions where we say we're not going to impose the harshest consequence. We're going to, you know, we're going to give people something that's not quite the maximum penalty that we could give.
We're talking with Jorge Barone, who's executive director of the Northwest Immigrants Rights Project. What is the misconception? What is it that, say, Trump supporters don't understand about the American undocumented immigrant?
Well, I think the thing that most frustrates me is this general sense that they're not contributing to the country. You know, the talk about not paying taxes. Well, you know, undocumented people are paying taxes all the time. Certainly here in our state, when we pay sales taxes, nobody's checking your immigration documents. So, you know, every person who's buying things in the country are paying taxes. But they're also paying a lot in payroll taxes. Many of them get the money taken out of their accounts, but because they might be working with a made-up Social Security number, for example, none of that is going to be to their benefit. They don't get any of the benefits. And there's actually been some studies showing that a lot of the Social Security benefits that are being paid out now are being paid out of the earnings of undocumented workers. So they're actually, you know, subsidizing retirement benefits for all Americans. And so there's a lot of this misconception that, you know, undocumented people are, you know, taking advantage of the system, when in fact they're actually providing a lot of benefits that all of us are, you know, getting advantage of.
My understanding is they also speak more English and commit fewer crimes than Americans tend to think.
Well, and that was one of the frustrating things, because, of course, the president-elect launched this idea of you know, the undocumented person as being, you know, criminal. And the reality is that actually, if you look at the research, you know, people who are born outside of the United States are actually less likely to end up in jail. I always joke around, because I myself are born outside of the United States. I don't want to, you know, chastise people who are born in the country. But statistically speaking, at least, I'm less likely to end up in jail than somebody who was born here.
Well, how did you immigrate here? What was your status?
Well, I was, and you know, that's one part of the reason that I do what I do, is because I recognize very much I had a very privileged opportunity to come here when I was 13. I came from Colombia. And I had the opportunity to come on a student visa with my mom, who was going to do a graduate degree here. And I came, you know, a person, my family had resources in Colombia. We were able to do that. We're one of the small segment of a lot of people in the world who can actually do that, who can afford to come here on a student visa. My mom eventually ended up remarrying here. And that's how we ended up getting permanent residence and eventually citizenship. And so that for me has been very important to recognize the privilege that I've had and to make sure that, you know, to the extent that we can try to change and balance the system that is very much stacked against our clients when you have the U.S. government as this very powerful force trying to deport somebody and people are not entitled to appointed attorneys and you know, there's very limited resources for them. We want to make sure that we try to tip the scales more in their favor.
Jorge Barone is executive director of the Northwest Immigrants' Rights Project. That story came from KUOW's immigration team. At our website, right now, you can read five different perspectives on how the Trump administration could affect undocumented immigrants in our region. We are tweeting that out right now at KUOW. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. When John Nearing became a Marysville City Council member in 2002, the town had fewer than 30,000 residents. Now he's the mayor, and Marysville is home to 60,000 people. So I asked him, what is the future he wants to help make for his fast-changing town?
You know, there's an interesting stat, and I'll get to answering directly your question, but there's an interesting stat I want to throw out there. Our median average income in Marysville rocketed up by $14,000 a year. I believe it was last year. And so that tells you something. I don't think that all of our current residents got on average a $14,000 a year raise. What it tells me is a lot of people are moving in from probably south, you know, that have good paying jobs, but they can't afford to live there anymore. And so they're moving to where housing is, or they get more house for their dollar. And so what I envision is you know, we are an area that is attracting, you know, some wealth into the community, which I think is a good thing in a lot of ways because that'll help fund new schools that we need and other things. But I also see as the vision for Marysville is that, you know, as a working class community, we want to provide jobs closer to home for our residents if they want them. And so what we've done is we've provided a lot of commercial opportunities so you can shop in Marysville, you can get all the services you need, and you can keep your money at home and you don't have to drive as far. We believe we've provided a lot of ways to recreate in Marysville for low cost or free recreation opportunities. What we need to do is provide or do our best to provide more family wage jobs. And so we have the Manufacturing Industrial Center that we're working on in coordination with the city of Arlington in the north part of Marysville, south part of Arlington, over 4,000 acres of area that's been zoned for light industry and manufacturing. And we hope to attract good paying jobs out there. We want a quality of life that's second to none. We want quality of recreation that's second to none. We would also like to provide you the opportunity, you know, if you want to have a family wage job in our community.
And what do your bosses, the Marysville citizens, tell you about any downside of change?
Well, certainly whenever you have, you know, the type of growth that we've experienced, you have more traffic. There's some help coming. It's a ways in the making here, but it is funded. And then we're doing some local road improvements to try and help as well. But there's no question that traffic is a concern of people. And then obviously as you grow too, people want to make sure you have the law enforcement personnel to take care of that increased growth. And so council and I have made it a priority to begin to beef up our police force. And so we're hiring extra officers every year to try and make sure we keep pace with that.
One of our Marysville listeners wrote to us, he owns a farm. And he reminded us first that Marysville grew partly because you annexed land 7 years ago. And he says the annexation happened without a vote or public input, that city leaders don't want agriculture, that crime is up. Quote, it is no fun living in this new empire of Marysville. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I would say everybody certainly is entitled to their own opinion on growth and how it goes, and I would say that everybody's thoughts should be considered on that. What I would say is that that was before I was mayor, but I was on the council, so I remember that annexation, and this is a really important point. We had about 20,000 residents that were right up the spine of this community. So in other words, you had City of Marysville residents to the west of them and to the east of them. And so what you had was literally a Marysville police officer could come service a house on a call on one block, and on the other side of the street, a few houses up, it was county. And so there was a lot of frustration by a lot of people of why can I not get the type of service that city residents are getting. And you got to remember, all these 20,000 were using our roads, we're using all the parks and all the things that taxpayers are paying for, but they were paying all their taxes to the county. And then you also have the fact that this was in our urban growth area. It eventually had to come into the city. That's what growth management is all about. So as city leaders, you sit and say, well, these people are using our roads, they're using our parks, they're using a lot of our services, they're not paying taxes to the city of Marysville, and they don't feel part of our community because when they call, they have to wait for a sheriff while their neighbor, gets a city police officer there within a few minutes. And so the vast majority of those people are happy to be in the city because of what I just told you. They're investing now in their own community and all the services they use. And of course, there's some that, and I believe I know the person you're talking about who has a farm and may feel like this wasn't the best thing for him. And I respect that. I don't have a problem with that. It's just when you're in city leadership, you have to look at what's best for the majority of folks. And that doesn't always mean that everybody comes out of it feeling great about it.
The mayor of Marysville, Washington, John Nearing, talking about growth in that community. And we'll be reporting on growth all around the Sound this year. Mayor, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Bill.
Are you living outside of Seattle in a part of this region that is having some of that amazing growth? Because we would like to hear your story and your take. Talk to us on Twitter with the hashtag Region of Boom. KUOW, Seattle 94.9. I'm Bill Radke, and this is The Record. In the Northwest, dairy cows make almost 57,000 tons of manure every day, 57,000 tons. And unless all that poop is carefully contained, it can get into waterways, cause pollution problems downstream. And that can lead to conflict. But in Northwest Washington, manure is bringing folks together, as EarthFix reporter Alicia O'Neill tells us.
Clamshells and pebbles crunch underfoot on the shore of the Lummi Nation's Portage Bay in Northwest Washington. At the lowest tides, Lummi fishermen can walk out to harvest clams.
Usually it's during nighttime.
25-year-old Lummi tribal fisherman Lonnie James Jr. has been digging clams since he was 6.
We go out there in headlights, a rake, garden rake, bucket, bag, and have to dress warm every time, and just, inch down in the ground, flop it over, there's a manila. You're bent over for about 5 to 6 hours.
It's hard work, but it's worth it, James says. In a good night, he digs up more than 100 pounds of clams and makes as much as $200. He says he relies on that income to help support his fiance and 3 kids. James isn't the only Lummi who relies on clam digging, says Chairman Tim Ballou.
Our elders have always taught us that when the tide's out, the table's set.
There's just one problem. Since 2014, the Portage Bay shellfish beds have been closed, and no one's been able to dig for clams there. That's because the fecal coliform levels are too high. Lonnie James Jr. says he's missing out on $10,000 a year. That pollution could have come from leaking septic tanks from Canada or from dairy farms. In Yakima, dairy farmers were sued for polluting the water. The 2015 settlement required them to line their manure storage lagoons with clay and plastic to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars. Dairy farmer Larry Stapp, who lives about 40 miles upstream of the Lummi Reservation, does not want this case to go the same route.
Nobody wins in court. I always say going to court is like going to war. Nobody wins. One just loses more than the other.
Instead, the Portage Bay Partnership was formed. seven of Whatcom County's 93 dairy farmers signed on, agreeing to donate money to Lummi fishermen who've lost income, and also to shellfish bed enhancement. And they'll manage manure better on their dairies, for instance, by planting buffers around streams to catch pollutants before they can make it into the water, by only spreading manure on fields during summer months, and by installing new storage containers. Stapp says he already has a steel storage tank.
This is the one that we put up a couple years ago.
The tank towers over us. It holds 1.5 million gallons. The idea is to get all the dairy farmers in Whatcom County to make the improvements Larry Stapp's already made on his farm. And that's just a first step. The signatories also hope to sign on more dairy farmers and to address any other sources of pollution.
That's our goal, is get those shellfish beds open. We don't like it when people can't harvest, whether it's shellfish or grass or milk or whatever, you know. We're all farmers together.
Back on the Lummi Reservation, Lonnie James Jr. says he's eager to get back out on Portage Bay.
I like to be out there with my friends, you know, not only my friends, you know, a lot of them are, you know, my brothers, cousins, you know. One of the main things I liked about it was getting to hang out with the older guys. Got to learn a lot of things from them. There's usually 100 people out there, you know, 100 people hanging out, just having fun, making money.
It'll be a few years before the water's clean enough for clamming, but the Portage Bay Partnership is trying to get Lummi fishermen back out as soon as possible. In Seattle, I'm Eilish O'Neill.
It's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. When President-elect Trump says, "Make America Great Again," some of his supporters hear that as a spiritual calling. We need to fulfill God's vision of America as a shining city on a hill. Well, our next guest is not a Trump supporter, but he does think America is part of a divine plan. Seattle author and conservative talk show host Michael Medved has written a new book called The American Miracle, Divine Providence in the Rise of the Republic. Medved says U.S. history is so improbable, so bizarre, that you can see God guiding us.
An example of that would be the mere fact that British settlement of the New World, as I talk about in the book, was 100 years late. The Spanish and the Portuguese and the Dutch and even the French were way ahead of the British. The British came late to the table, but they were the ones who succeeded ultimately. The British colonies became, and again, it's not just the United States here, it's also north of the border, it's our Canadian cousins. We became more successful, more prosperous. Now, basically, how do you explain it? And there are three possible ways to explain it. Number one, the most popular way today is we were rapacious, we were exploitative, we committed genocide against the native inhabitants, we enslaved Africans, we raped the environment, we were terrible people. Okay. Lots of terrible.
Well, the terrible part is a judgment, but all you said is true, right?
To some extent, it is. But the point over here would be, if that was the secret of America's success, why weren't the Spanish colonies more successful? Because they were more harsh. Why weren't the Portuguese colonies more successful? They were more dependent on slavery. A third of the population of Brazil today is descended from former slaves. Really, I mean, it's huge. So they were worse, more exploitative, but they were less successful. So that explanation doesn't work. The second explanation is basically that it's a series of happy accidents. But I make the case in the book, a pattern of happy accidents is still a pattern.
What about our tremendous natural resources and we don't have neighbors attacking us, and we have a wise, stable system of government? There's lots of positive reasons.
Well, the wise, stable system of government is a reason that other countries don't have. The other stuff is stuff that other countries do have. I mean, in terms of great natural resources, Brazil is pretty well set up. Canada is certainly very well set up. Russia is enormously well set up. The United States has, yes, had all kinds of natural blessings, but there's so many of them, and it's so many key points in history, and that's what I write about. There's almost freakish good fortune.
Talking to Michael Medved, author of The American Miracle, a lot of people claim divine favor. What do you conclude from this story of, as you say, freakish successes and chances?
Just that America is part of some bigger plan. because we're talking.
Who's
about,
not part of a big plan? I mean, what? Right. Let's be specific about what you're saying about.
I will entirely.
Okay.
And again, this goes to the third alternative, which is okay. It's not because America is the worst country in the world that we're the most powerful. It's not because America is just a series of happy accidents, because there's so many of them and they're so regularly in America's favor that still indicates a pattern. It's design. Now, the question is, who designed it? If you believe the design is a product of the founders, they themselves, to a man, including people who are religious skeptics, believed that they were the instruments of a design, not its authors.
Are you saying America must be God's favorite?
It's not God's favorite. It's just part of God's instrument. In other words, I'm not arguing that Americans deserve special blessings. I'm arguing that that America is there, really, to play a very positive role for all of humanity.
Positive and negative, as you've said, yes? Crimes against humanity? I mean, we're balancing the whole picture.
And when you look at the balance of the whole picture, I talk about the Bedford Falls experiment. George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life was not a perfect person. He could be kind of mean to his wife,
yeah,
by Donna Reed.
Yes.
But he was a good person. And the same is true of the United States. You could say that, the United States has done things that are wrong and damaging. However, the United States has been an unimaginable blessing to humanity. And a large part of that is the American economic system, the ideals of free thought, of freedom of action, and yes, private property and free enterprise. And all of that, which has been distinctively advanced by the United States of America, has been a blessing not only to Americans but to humanity.
Some listeners might think that you're talking about American exceptionalism in this Donald Trump Make America Great way. You were a never Trumper and got in trouble for it.
But again,
Your conservative colleagues,
I happen to believe that every patriotic American wants the new president to succeed beyond anyone's expectations. And I do. And by the way, I said the same thing about President Obama. I was very critical of conservatives when President Obama came in and said, I want him to fail. How can you want the American president to fail? If the American president fails, our country fails. And I don't want our country to fail. I want our country to continue to succeed. And in any event, the point about this is that one of my big problems with Donald Trump is his sense of American success, making America great again, had to do with simply wealth and economic success for the United States itself. I believe that America has a role in the world and that the entire world suffers by American isolationism and a withdrawal to an America First mentality. I don't really think that an America First mentality is American. Americans have always seen our nation as particularly important in a grand scheme of things. I believe we are meant to continue to be important in a grand scheme of things, because if America does not lead the world and help to work for a more orderly, humane, decent world, if America doesn't do that, who will? I don't trust Vladimir Putin. I don't trust China.
So maybe God's plan is for us to elect terrible leaders and to fail?
No. And again, well, I don't.
Countries come and go. Empires come and go.
They do. And certainly America has had some setbacks. But really, they've been so incredibly minor in the overall scheme.
So far.
Yeah, so far.
How do you know you're not a little early?
Could be.
We're talking with Seattle's own nationally syndicated conservative talk radio host and author Michael Medved, whose latest book is called The American Miracle, Divine Providence in the Rise of the Republic. You quote a skeptical writer in your book who says, the human brain is designed to reject the random, the haphazard, the arbitrary. We can't accept that accidents happen. You know, skeptical of your theory of divine providence. Sometimes stuff just happens. There are lots of Judeo-Christians who don't think you can find God's plan in a history book. What makes you so confident?
Well, part of it is that I go here with Tolstoy and Hegel. who are two pretty big guns on my side. I still consider to be War and Peace. And not just the novelistic parts of War and Peace, which people know, but the philosophical parts of the book War and Peace, which have to do with the will of history, that it is impossible to look at a big event and think that this is purely, purely accidental. And again, the biggest event in the last 500 years, by far, in the history of the world, the biggest development, the one that's most consequential, has been the emergence of the United States, which has changed everything.
And I still want to know if you're going to write another book if our luck runs out.
Yes. First of all,
I mean, what do you make of the Dust Bowl and 9/11 and Katrina and the election that you president you detest? You know, it comes and it goes.
It does, but one could argue that the greatest disaster in all of American history, if you want to talk about events that seem random, the one point where our luck really seemed to run out is the assassination of Abraham Lincoln of April of 1865, when he was needed most for Reconstruction. And he saw himself, first of all, he forecast his own death repeatedly. And the real miracle, I argue, is not that he was killed. It was that he was survived until he was able to get the 13th Amendment enacted, get the slaves formally freed as part of the Constitution. That's the story they tell in the movie Lincoln. And also that he survived until definitive Union victory.
But Michael, can you also understand how it could be offensive to hear, look at all the wonderful things that have happened, especially you use the example of Lincoln. The context is the blood and suffering of so many people because of United States policy,
which you're well aware of. Which Lincoln talked about. In other words, if you read his second inaugural address, which he delivered just days before he died, he asks about he talks about the Civil War and the 700,000 people we now know who died during the Civil War as a justice or a price paid by America for the crime of slavery.
So, Michael, if you believe that God favors America, what do you do with that information? Like, what's the difference? How do you act differently if you do believe your argument, your case in your book, or if you don't? If you just say, we did some good, some bad, stuff happens, and I don't see the plan, but let's all do our best. What's the difference?
The difference is it's not a vision of God favoring America the way that we might favor the Seahawks or the Mariners. That's not the idea. It's not God's rooting. He's wearing America gear and saying, yeah, USA, USA, USA. It's the idea.
But we're an important part of a divine plan.
Correct. We're an instrument.
An instrument. So what do you do differently if you do believe that versus if you don't?
You try to serve that higher purpose. There's a non-American statesman who I quote at the very conclusion of my book named Otto von Bismarck. He has this remarkable quote, which I hope someone can get to President-elect Trump. And what Bismarck said is it is the job of the statesman to listen to God's footsteps in history and then to grab hold of his coattails and hang on. In other words, what does it mean to understand that America has a special place in the cosmos, in the will of history, in the Hegelian will of history, in this great scheme of things? And we clearly do. So what does it mean if you understand that? And what it means is that, yeah, we have special responsibilities. I repeatedly in the book, I make...
World leadership? Is that basically the special responsibility?
No, the special responsibilities is for America to stand for something, to America to stand for goodness and for decency and for justice and, like Superman, truth, justice, and the American way.
That's the plan.
The plan really is to call up what Lincoln described as the better angels of our nature. I think part of what it means, what the message of the American miracle is to look for that invisible hand, to try to see not what we're entitled to do, but what we're expected to do, not what that higher power, that invisible hand, gives to us, but what that higher power, that invisible hand, demands of us.
Michael Medved is the author of The American Miracle. He hosts a nationally syndicated radio show here in Seattle. His opposition to Donald Trump has cost him some business. Some of those conservative radio stations dumped his show because he's anti-Trump. Have you paid a price for your stance on the election? KOW listener Michael Ramey told us the election cost him a friendship.
I grew up in the Midwest with my best friend I've known for 59 years of my 61 years of age. We went to school together, college together, church together, and life together. He's the godfather of my son. He's very affluent back in the Midwest. It's a large company. And voted for Trump. And we had our discussions this year. And we ended up just stopped talking because he didn't want to hear anything of it. Quote, unquote, Rames, you don't like him because he's a winner. And so we just don't talk anymore. Don't even talk about the Chiefs or the Seahawks or our kids or anything because we're just so different now.
We've heard from several of you with stories like Michael's, fathers and children, brothers and sisters, lifelong friends not speaking because of an election. How do you move past that divide? If you have worked on healing an election breakup, we'd love to know how you're doing it. We need your advice. So does Michael. Give us a call, would you? 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke.